Thank you very much for inviting me. It's always great to tell people about the Cherry work. The project's been ongoing now for 10 years, and quite a large cast of characters and many contributions at many levels of the stack. So actually at this point I think we've done about 140 engineer years of effort on this. So I'll do my best to summarise it in over the next sort of 40 minutes. I should very quickly acknowledge all the support we've had from DARPA as well as other sponsors. Let me move to the agenda though. So I'm going to structure the talk as following. Firstly, give you some motivation. You know, what are we trying to do? What are we trying to solve? I'm going to give you a very high level overview of the Cherry hardware architecture. Tell you a little bit about the software models that you can build on top of that architecture. Then tell you some specifics about some RISC-V variants that we've done. And I thought, because you know some of you are microarchitects, I wanted to tell you a little bit about some of the microarchitectural advances we've done to make Cherry security on RISC-V efficient. And then finally finish up with a look at exploitation paths and a few conclusions. So let's move to motivation. Motivation is really all about memory safety, and I'll give you two examples. The first one, Matt Miller at Microsoft Response Center indicated in his Blue Hat 2019 talk that really over the last sort of 10 plus years, 70% of all of their vulnerabilities have been memory safety bugs. And very much the first in first place is spatial memory safety, and Cherry directly addresses spatial memory safety. So this is mitigating things like buffer overflows and so on. And the second place is really more sort of temporal memory safety. So things like use after free. And in fact, we've been doing work more recently on temporal memory safety, exploiting certain features of the Cherry architecture. In particular, we end up tagging all pointers, and that ends up being fundamentally important to mitigating use after free vulnerabilities. This is, of course, not just a Microsoft phenomenon. I mean, we see similar things being reported by other people. Here we've got an example from the Chromium team at Google, and they say that 70% of all their serious security vulnerabilities are memory safety bugs. So we just want to get rid of these. So let me just give you a quick example. What is a memory safety vulnerability, and you know how do they arise? And I'll turn to an XKCD comic to help me here. This is the Heartbleed bug, which is now a few years old, but it's a nice one to explain. So Heartbleed is all to do with the heartbeat message in the TLS protocol. And of course, we know that the TLS protocol is used to secure, in particular, web transactions. And so, you know, you want to make sure that when you're talking to your bank, that, you know, that data can't get intercepted. It turns out the crypto and all the security protocol stuff really sound. However, there is a heartbeat message as part of this protocol that is there to keep the link active. And it turned out that this is where the vulnerability lay. So the heartbeat message basically just sends a message to the server to say, "Hello server, are you still there?" And here in this comic example, we're saying, "Hello server, say potato." And the server says potato. And then, you know, the client says, "Are you still there? Say bird, four letters." And the server, sure enough, says bird. Then the client gets a bit too clever and says, "Hello server, are you still there? Say hat." And hat is 500 letters. And sure enough, the server says hat. And then it also gives you a whole load of other information. It basically does a buffer overread. And in that buffer overread ended up being keys and other things that then allow you to break into the system. I mean, this is pretty crazy, right? Why are these sort of vulnerabilities still in our code? You know, what went wrong and how can we do better? Well, the classical answer, and really what industry is doing at the moment, is basically stupid programmer. You forgot to check the bounds of the data structure. And it turns out it's a one-line fix. And, you know, what the industry will do now is say, oops, we made a mistake. We'll patch that and, you know, do a re-release on that library or that browser. But the problem is, you know, we're seeing this all the time. People are just keep on patching things and patching things, and they're not really getting to the root cause of what the problems are. So our answer is a bit different. We want to do things like preserve bounds information during compilation, and we want to use our Cherry processor to dynamically check those bounds with very little overhead, but also guaranteed pointer integrity and provenance. And we also want other properties as well. For example, we'd like to reduce the attack surface. So observation is software basically keeps getting bigger. You know, it's a very common paradigm now that when we write applications, we make very extensive use of large libraries. And you all of a sudden end up with an application that's got a very large code base. And this is great. From a software engineering point of view, it means we make very rapid progress. We can prototype applications rapidly. This is all good practice, except from a security point of view. It really aids the attacker because we basically make the attack surface bigger and bigger. And that, from an attacker's perspective, expands the number of ways you can break into the system. So really we want to apply an idea that really comes from the 1960s, the idea of the principle of least privilege. We want application level least privilege. So we want to use software compartmentalization to decompose software into isolated compartments that are delegated very limited rights. And so, for example, you know, if you're reading, if you've got an email client, you know, if you're reading a message, that should be in a compartment. If you want to render an image, that should be in a compartment. And of course, if you open an attachment, that should be in a compartment. And we know that this fundamentally mitigates both known and unknown vulnerabilities. So it's a very powerful technique. And in fact, application least privilege is used increasingly on devices like tablets and mobile phones, where they use process-based compartmentalization. And that works, but it turns out it's just not scalable. And similarly, in your web browser, that, you know, if you use something like a Chromium browser, Chrome uses process-based compartmentalization so that each tab is in its own compartment until you get 50 to 100 tabs, and at which point, actually, you hit the virtual memory system so badly that they start sharing compartments between tabs. So before you know it, your banking access is sharing a compartment with Facebook or whatever else you've got up at the time. This is clearly a bad idea. So we want to be able to do very efficient compartmentalization. So basically, to conclude this little bit, we really want to uphold two principles. The first one is what we tend to refer to as the principle of intentional use. So basically, we want to ensure that software runs the way the programmer intended, not the way the attacker tricked it. And this includes things like guarded pointer integrity and provenance, efficient and dynamic bounds checking, and also ensuring that you can't turn these protections off. The other one is to really be able to exploit the principle of least privilege. We want to be able to reduce the attack surface using software compartmentalization. And we want it to be highly scalable and highly efficient. We also really want to preserve the sort of risk philosophy as we do this. And so, for example, we really don't want to add things like crypto. And our model doesn't rely on crypto at all. I've seen quite a lot of work where people add security to processors, and often one of the tools that people sort of use first is cryptography. But the trouble is, cryptography comes with an awful lot of overheads, and you then also have a problem of how do you do all the key management. So if you don't need crypto, my feeling is you're better off without it. We also don't want a lot of elaborate microcode. We don't want new lookup tables. We don't want exotic external memories. If we can avoid it, we don't want to extend the pipeline. We don't want to reduce the clock frequency. And we also don't want to reduce the number of addressing modes. And, you know, prior designs that have been somewhat cherry-like have generally relied on any number of these things. We do, on the other hand, want low-level hardware functionality on which many software structures can be built. We want it to be compiler-friendly, and we really want the compiler, linker, and runtime system to do much of the work, not the instruction set plus the decoder. So this is sort of the part of the risk philosophy, really. You know, keep it as simple as possible, rely on the compiler to do a lot of the clever stuff for you and provide just the necessarily low-level hardware functions. Okay. So I'd now like to move on to talking about the actual Cherry hardware architecture in the abstract. So how do we achieve these goals I've set out? Well, the first thing we do is we add a new data type. So a bit like adding floating point to a system, we add a capability. And the capability on Cherry is an in-memory capability. It is a bounds checked pointer with integrity and provenance properties. It's held in memory and also in new or extended registers. So in RISC-V, in fact, we just extend the integer register file. So the capability is formed of a 64-bit address. So we've still got the address, if you like, for every pointer. And to that, we then add compressed bounds and permissions and an SBIT, which I will come back to in a minute. And that gets you up to 128 bits. And people start grimacing slightly at this point. It's like, you're going to make all my pointers twice as big. Well, yes, we are. We will see shortly what the overheads look like. But you are going to pay something for this protection. We also add a hidden validity tag, which is absolutely critical for the security arguments. And this, when I've given variants of this talk, particularly in industrial contexts, commercial computer architects start grimacing at this point and say, we don't want 129-bit memory, thank you. Well, I will show you later on that actually we can achieve this using standard memory and do so very efficiently, but it does require a little bit of cunningness. So using this capability, it is basically a bounds check pointer. So we've got bounds that refer to a region of memory. The address is within those bounds. We actually allow the address to typically to stray up to a page above and below the bounds during address calculations. And we found pragmatically that's needed if you want to just be able to recompile legacy C code without any problems. But nevertheless, with those constraints that the address has to be within the compressed bounds, that actually allows us to do some cunning maths to reduce the top and bottom values, which would otherwise be 64-bit values, down to something a lot shorter. We add the permissions and the validity tag, as I've already mentioned. We also add some new instructions. So we've got new load and stores via bounds checked capabilities, and you get an exception if the address is out of range when you do that dereference. We also provide instructions to do guarded manipulation of capabilities. So you can decrease bounds, you can decrease the permissions, you can adjust the address, and you can extract the bit fields. Some things are absolutely critical for security. So the monotonic decrease in the writes are absolutely critical, and therefore we do formal verification to guarantee that no matter what the code sequence, and even if you've got an interrupt partway through a code sequence or an exception or whatever, there is no way you can increase your writes in any way. Let's just talk a bit about this hidden S-bit. We also have what's called sealed capabilities, and these are used for compartmentalization. So sealed capabilities are non-dereferenceable capabilities. In other words, you can't use them as a data or a code pointer. You have to unseal them to use them, and we're going to use them for compartmentalization. Basically, we add an object type, which is typically, in a 64-bit system, it's 24 bits. We further compress the bounds, and we set the sealed bit to 1. Then we actually have a calling convention, which is basically involves having a sealed code capability and a sealed data capability. And those describe a sandbox. So the code capability describes the code region that you're going to execute from, and the data sealed data capability describes the data region of that compartment. There is a CCall instruction, which basically just compares the object types, and those get then unsealed to program counter capability and a default data capability. Which sort of brings me nicely onto software models. Okay. So, you know, at a machine level, we have capabilities and instructions, and they basically provide the building blocks on which various software models can be built. And I think it's worth just thinking about a little concrete analogy, just so you get the right feel for this. If we look at something like a translation look-aside buffer used in virtual memory, then from a machine level, you know, we've got page tables, we've probably got a hardware page table walker, and the hardware understands basically what virtual to physical translation is. But I wouldn't say the hardware really understands virtual memory in all of its nuances. Okay, so for example, it may be that on the software side, you want to have ideas like guard pages around data structures, for example. Well, the hardware doesn't know what a guard page is. I mean, it understands that there might be a page that you're not allowed to access. But you see, you can start building on top of these low-level mechanisms, more abstract mechanisms. Hope that makes sense. We get a similar thing with Cherry. And really, we can operate Cherry in a sort of more compatible mode all the way through to a safer mode. And we're generally looking for, you know, source and binary compatibility. So we want to be able to support C language in idioms and idioms from other languages, multiple ABIs, and so on. So at one extreme, we can still run unmodified code. So you can just run an unmodified binary, but you're not going to get any of the security benefits at all. In the middle, we've got hybrid code. So here, if you're writing C, then you would very explicitly annotate when you want to turn a pointer into a capability. And actually, this hybrid code we tend to use quite sparingly in practice. And it's mainly used if you need to interface between unmodified code and pure capability code. In pure capability code, we recompile from source and automatically convert all pointers, both code and data, into capabilities. So at this point, the actual binary isn't interoperable with legacy code because you've changed all the pointer sizes. However, in practice, and we've recompiled swathes of stuff now, you can recompile an awful lot of C code and it works just fine, and you get all the security benefits. And so, you know, using our Clang LLVM compiler, which can generate code for all three modes, as I said, you get an awful long way just taking an existing application and recompiling it. And we found all sorts of things. You know, we've recompiled, you know, all the standard command line tools you'll get in a Unix distribution, and found all sorts of things like, you know, TC shell has a buffer underrun error if you do history completion having not typed anything. And we think that bug's been around for over 20 years, But you recompile it with Cherry, run TC shell, and you suddenly discover you mitigate a vulnerability. If you've got pure capability code, you also need a capability-aware ABI, a Cherry ABI. So you could view the Cherry ABI as a compatibility layer on top of the operating system. So basically, you can use capabilities as references when you do operating system calls. And you could view this as it's a bit like a 32-bit compatibility layer for a 64-bit operating system. Okay, and once you've got Cherry ABI, we can just recompile lots of code and it just works, including all the libraries. The main thing we do find that we have to fix the security vulnerabilities in the code. So you've got to fix the bugs, but apart from that, it just works. We've actually taken things further. So more recently, we've been pushing capabilities into the kernel itself, into the FreeBSD kernel. And at which point, actually, we end up with a native Cherry ABI. And then on top of that, we have 32-bit and 64-bit legacy compatibility layers to run your legacy applications. So we published a paper at ASPLOS April 2019 on the Cherry ABI work, and that won Best Paper Prize. It works very well, and we've ported large applications like, you know, PostgreSQL and WebKit on top of this ABI layer. As part of our DARPA work, we've also needed to throw things over the wall, and this is a bit of a grab shot that I did at a DARPA PI meeting, where we needed to throw things over the wall to MIT Lincoln Labs, who were red teaming the activity. And it was one of those slightly amusing PI meetings where my team had spent absolutely ages producing demos. But by far the best demo of our work was in the red team's booth, where they demonstrated that just recompiling the Heartbleed code mitigated the vulnerability. Give you a bit of an idea of how you might do compartmentalization as part of the software model. And we're still exploring different ways of doing compartmentalization at the moment. So I'm just going to skim over this right now. So we want isolated compartments that are basically created using closed graphs of capabilities. And this is combined with constrained non-monotonic domain transitions. So we do allow sort of transitions between compartments using the SQL mechanism. Okay. So if we've got one protection domain A, you know, it's got its state. There will also be some shared state, say, between these protection domains. And that is one graph of capabilities. And then similarly, protection domain B will have its own graph of capabilities. And you can safely share data and code. We've got a flexible set of shared resources. Now, I said early on, we want very efficient compartmentalization. And one way of presenting that is to look at a micro benchmark. So here we've got a very simple micro benchmark where we're basically just transporting a payload from one compartment to another compartment. The red curve is process-based compartmentalization, and the blue curve is a co-process model built up using Cherry. And it's a log-log graph. So to the students there, you should always be wary of log-log graphs because you can hide all sorts of things. But it's sort of necessary here because we're showing orders of magnitude performance improvement. So on the y-axis, we've got number of cycles the processor runs on an FPGA. On the x-axis, we've got the payload. And you can see that the payload goes from 1 byte up to several kilobytes. And we're orders of magnitude faster when we've got small payloads. And even once we've got, you know, several kilobytes of payload, it's still a lot more efficient. Moreover, the compartmentalization scales indefinitely. You know, you can have an arbitrary number of compartments with Cherry with no performance overhead. However, process-based compartmentalization, there is an enormous overhead due to all the new virtual address spaces you have. We also use capabilities for control flow. So we return all control pointers. So things like return addresses become capabilities. And this really adds a lot of robustness against things like return-oriented programming attacks and jump-oriented programming attacks. And it's really much better than current probabilistic approaches. So for instance, you know, if you use Linux, all the code that gets shipped with things like Ubuntu has address-based layout randomization turned on. And you do pay a performance penalty from doing so. It's not enormous, but it is a few percent. And that gives you statistical protection. One of the nice things with Cherry is that it gives you completely deterministic protection. Let me briefly mention temporal memory safety. So we're also interested in things like use after free vulnerabilities. Cherry hardware doesn't directly help you with it in a way. It doesn't directly stop temporal memory safety, but it allows you to build temporal safety on top of the hardware. Critically, we have these validity tags on all pointers, so on all object references. And this makes it easy to sweep and revoke pointers in the system. We're also looking at hardware optimization to make software scanning for tags more efficient. We've had a couple of recent papers on this. CherryVoke at Micro characterizing pointer revocation, and then the Cornucopia work, which was at IEEE Security and Privacy, looking at temporal safety for heaps, where we'd done all the operating system work and all the work needed to do the sweeping. Cornucopia gives us state-of-the-art runtime overheads. So if we just run on a single core, then the geometric mean is 5.8% overhead. And if we do revocation, which is somewhat analogous to garbage collections, if we do it concurrently, then typically the overhead is below 2%. We're still looking at ways of making this even more efficient, but the results look very promising. So just to summarize this section, Cherry provides pointer integrity, it provides bounds on pointers, it provides monotonicity, so you can't increase your privileges, and the permissions mean that you can't confuse things like data and code. It also provides us a mechanism to provide to support very efficient compartmentalization and gives us efficient temporal safety. So next I'm going to talk about building Cherry RISC-V cores. We've done all sorts of implementations. In fact, this is an example sort of FPGA-based tablet that we did that was based on an early Cherry MIPS design. We've more recently done 32-bit tiny microcontroller on a RISC-V-based platform. We've done a sort of classic five-stage pipeline processor flute that's either 64-bit or 32-bit. And more recently, we've been working on an out-of-order processor based on MIT's RISC-E00 core. We've also been doing a lot of work on sort of specification and verification and working with the RISC-V community on this. So my colleague Peter Sewell's been leading an effort on the SAIL language to formally specify instruction sets, including RISC-V. And that's available, and we've done the Cherry version of that. We've also got quite an interesting tool, TestRig, for directed random testing with test case shrinkage that we've been using. All our code's written in BlueSpec, and TestRig's written in BlueSpec. And this has proven to be very effective at finding bugs in the Cherry RISC-V cores and allowing us to bring implementations up quickly. We've also done a lot of software work. My colleagues have done work on the, you know, the compiler front. So there's extensive compiler and linker support for capabilities, full operating system support. We've got very good support in FreeBSD. And we've also been looking at real-time operating systems as well. And observations are that, you know, on the BSD platform, you know, we need very few source code changes to recompile C and C++ to use Cherry features. The compiler actually is now has been improved to provide quite a lot of warnings for idioms that tend to cause problems as well. We've got lots of sort of user space and demo applications, so lots of systems libraries, you know, all the sort of standard system tools and applications as well, like PostgreSQL, Nginx. We've done a lot with WebKit, big chunks of WebKit now work. And we've also been working extensively on the software side to minimize privilege for pointers and using pointers capabilities within the kernel as well. We've also been doing a lot of work as part of the of a DARPA project, Sith, and I'm not going to say much on this, but they've been developing large suites of test cases that basically test a lot of the CVEs and put them into sort of a potted form, and we pass all the memory safety tests. Let me tell you a bit about the micro-architectural advances. So what do we need to actually make capabilities efficient? Well, one of the ones I've talked about already is coming up with a fairly compact capability format. So for a 64-bit processor, we have 128-bit capabilities with a 129th-bit validity tag. Originally, in fact, for our early Cherry MIPS work, we used an uncompressed format. So capabilities were 256 bits. And that was really bad for caching. And so we looked at how to to basically compress the bounds information. And we also looked at how to sort of minimize the costs within the core when we want to manipulate capabilities. So for instance, in our MIPS work, MIPS, you know, has this old-fashioned idea of coprocessors. And so, you know, with MIPS, you have a floating point coprocessor, and it made sense with that instruction set to add a capability coprocessor. But for RISC-V, we've merged the capability registers with the integer register file. So if you like, the capability bounds and permissions are held in like a sidecar of the integer register file. And this really reduces things like the amount of rename logic you need and so on. So how do we do this sort of compression? I'm not going to give you too many details, but basically we've got the address, we've got the upper and lower bounds, and what we look to do is share bits from the address. So for small regions of memory, you know, just a few kilobytes, then the top and bottom bits are actually aligned to the zero bit of the address. And so in this case, our exponent would be zero. For larger objects, we basically introduce an alignment requirement if you want precise bounds. And so for larger objects, we effectively shift the top and bottom bits to the left by an exponent amount. So this is almost like floating point. And we use then the lower bits of the top and bottom are zero, and the upper bits of top and bottom are basically derived from the address. There's quite a lot of arithmetic involved, and there's quite a lot of subtlety. So if you're interested in that, I will refer you to IEEE Transactions on Computers paper that came out last year that has all the maths and the formal proof in it. We also had to deal with this tag bit, the validity tag. Now that needs to appear in registers and in memory, so all the way through the cache hierarchy and all the way out to DRAM. Just to remind you, that tag bit is absolutely critical for the security properties. And conventional operations, so you know, arithmetic on just conventional arithmetic on a capability or a conventional load or store operation will result in the tag being cleared. We also guarantee that any capability manipulations can only decrease the access right. So how do we do this in the pipeline? So we need to propagate the tags all the way from DRAM up to registers and back. So obviously within the registers and the on-chip caches, it's very easy to add an extra bit. So, you know, having a register that's 129 bits wide is not a problem. In the D-cache, of course, and it's very easy to expand the size of the cache to include that tag bit. It's really only when we get out to DRAM that we run into a problem because, you know, we want to use conventional off-the-shelf DIMMs. What we do on most of our implementations is introduce a tag cache in a tag controller that is basically logically part of the DRAM controller. So from a coherency point of view, this is all very straightforward. So the entire memory system supports tags, and you know, the interface to the DRAM controller supports tags, and it's only really at the point where the DRAM gets written to off-chip, the data gets written to off-chip DRAM, that we really need to think about it. And what we actually do is store the tags in an upper region of the DRAM. So effectively we shrink the DRAM by 1% and store the tags in that upper region. So there are no consistency issues at all. However, we do have issues of how do you make that tag cache efficient. And one thing that's quite interesting about this problem from a microarchitectural perspective is if your L1 and if your entire cache hierarchy is quite substantial, then by the time memory transactions drop out the bottom of the last level cache, then you've used up a huge amount of temporal and spatial locality. So you would think that actually, if you're going to sort of cache these tag bits, it's not going to work very well. However, if you're going to do the analysis, and actually if you start thinking about it a bit more, if we have a sort of conventional sized cache line that only holds tag bits, so if you've got 64 bytes in your tag cache, that holds one validity bit for every 128 bits. So therefore, a 64 byte cache line covers 8 kilobytes of data. In other words, if you come to fetch some data from memory and you miss in the tag cache fetches 2 pages worth of tags in one go. And that actually plays very nicely with the last level cache. So you actually get quite good spatial hits. Not so good on the temporal front. But we actually take things further. In fact, that tag caching scheme we presented to ARM, who we were working with, and we showed them a whole load of benchmarks, and we said, well, for all the MyBench stuff, it's usually below 1%. That's good enough, isn't it? And the ARM people said, no, we don't want to pay 1% overhead. You've got to do better. So we went back to the drawing board, and we thought, okay, so what can we do? What can we observe about the system? Well, firstly, many of the cache lines in memory just don't contain any tags at all. So you've got large regions of code and large blocks of data and disk caches and things. So therefore, tags are actually quite sparse. And really, we only want to pay for tagging when it's actually needed. So then we started looking at a hierarchical approach to representing the tags. So here I've got an example of a two-level table. So in the root table, we have one bit that says whether an 8K region of memory has tags or not. Okay, so if there's a 1, then there are some tags in that region of memory. If there's 0, there are no tags in that memory. Okay, and that does mean that even with a fairly modest sized root table, you cover an enormous region of memory. Okay, and it also means that if you're fetching cache lines and the root table says there are no tags in that region, you can just propagate that up and you never need to look at the leaf table at all. So it effectively amplifies the cache capacity. So the hierarchy approach effectively does a sort of compression on the data. We can also apply other techniques. So we can do things like silent write elimination, so we don't mark any tag cache lines. So if a tag cache line isn't dirty, we never write it back. And this also plays very nicely with the idea that we can do tag cache line fabrication. So, you know, often the operating system, or if you've got ECC in the system, you'll be zeroing memory regularly. So we know that in the root table, many, many cache lines worth of data will be all zeros and there'll be no tags at all. So when you come to, say if you want to write a capability to a region of memory that's never had any capabilities before, and we have to have we basically have to create that lower, that's odd, I can't go backwards now. We can basically fabricate the leaf level table because we know it's full of zeros to begin with. So by the time we've applied these techniques for things, for benchmarks like MyBench, basically the overheads are zero. I mean, it's very hard to measure any overhead at all. And if we take very, very pointer heavy benchmarks, so the examples from the Octane switch, which do things like, follow linear linked lists. So you're doing lots and lots of pointer manipulation. Even then, for the uncompressed table, you know, we were seeing overheads as high as 8%. But once we've got the compression in, it gets it down to 4%. And for many other things, it's below 1%. So in other words, there's lots and lots of optimizations that can be done to reduce the overheads of applying Cherry to a pipeline. What I'd like to do now is just tell you very briefly about exploitation paths, and then we can wrap up and take questions. So in the UK, we've got an industrial strategy challenge fund set up called Digital Security by Design, £80 million fund with a further £117 million coming from industry. And this is going to produce a Cherry ARM-based demonstrator and lots of software support, and it's funding 10 different academic groups in the UK to do further research and other industrialists. So it's a really exciting effort. We've provided an open source stack for research and deployment. So we've got Cherry RISC-V documentation, specs, simulators, toolchain, operating system work, and a number of hardware implementations. But these sort of full stack changes are not easy. It has taken us 10 years so far, about 140 engineer years of effort. And we've received on the order of $26 million worth of funding so far. Over the next 5 years through this new UK initiative, there's going to be further $200 million worth of funding. And actually, we should get the ARM Morello board. So this is going to be a 6-nanometer system on chip with quad 64-bit Cherry ARM cores, so a pretty high-end chip. That should be with us at the end of 2021. And then we're looking at early commercial adoption, and we wait to see what the cost will be for full adoption of this system. I really hope we're going to get there, but we're told by ARM that the cost could be as high as $10 billion by the time there's full adoption. Let me just conclude then. So Cherry provides hardware with much more semantic knowledge of what the programmer intended, and this really pushes us toward the idea of the principle of intentional use. So basically, the code runs the way you intended it to run, not the way the attacker tried to trick you. We provide very efficient pointer integrity and bounds checking, and this eliminates things like buffer overflows and buffer overreads, you know, which have been vulnerabilities that have been known about for over 30 years and yet still cause problems. We provide very efficient, scalable compartmentalization, and this allows the principle of least privilege to be applied to mitigate both known and unknown attacks. We get large performance improvements over process-based compartmentalization. So that's really interesting. If you look at something like a mobile phone or a tablet, what we're actually saying there is you could apply Cherry and get better security and better performance. We're currently working with the industry and the open source community to deploy this technology. With that, I'd like to finish and take questions. Thank you.